This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had to be everyday grind.
Night transmissions.
Hello, this is Gary Clinton, and I got another nice draught of freshly brewed night transmissions for you, number 131, unless I've lost count, which is possible, you never know. Generally, when I'm introducing suspense, I keep it simple, and I'm going to keep it simple again today. And only mention William Spear, who was the guiding light of suspense, and the original producer and director. But there were other producer-directors who very significantly contributed to the success of the program. But the plot formula devices are followed in all but a handful of episodes. The protagonist was usually a normal person who was suddenly dropped into a threatening or bizarre situation. And the solutions were withheld until the last possible second. Evildoers were usually punished in the end. But during its 20 years on the air, like I said, it did have other producers and directors, besides William Spear. There was Norman MacDonald and Anton M. Leader, and Elliot Lewis, who is a radio legend in his own right. This episode tonight, for example, was produced by Elliot Lewis and displays a sophistication that during the Lewis years became the hallmark of the program. Lewis also substantially increased the number of Hollywood A-list performers brought to the show. Tonight, for example, stars Jack Benny. I would have thought that anyone who spoke English was familiar with Jack Benny. That certainly turned out to not be universally true. A decade or so ago, we had a house guest, a very intelligent, lively young man from Wales, who, to my surprise, had never heard of Jack Benny. Now, I know I've got a couple of people in Great Britain who listen to the program. Is this common? I mean, was Andy just an exception? Or is the brilliant Jack Benny just not as well known in Britain? I mean, he hasn't been a household name in a long time. Dying as he did in 1974. Right up into 1974, there's hardly an American performer who's more famous. On the other hand, his career was vaudeville, radio, and television. So I don't know. And he was also unfamiliar with George Carlin. Now, like I said, I don't know. Hard to imagine, though, that Jack Benny wasn't appreciated anywhere they spoke English. Anyway, that's enough of that. This episode is from June the 2nd of 1962. Sorry, make that 1952. That is called A Good and Faithful Servant.
Tonight, Autolite presents a story about a man who worked for 30 years to prepare a most unique personal retirement plan. The story is called A Good and Faithful Servant. Our star, Mr. Jack Benny. And now, with the performance of Mr. Jack Benny, Autolite presents transcribed A Good and Faithful Servant, hoping once again to keep you in suspense.
I know you've been through a lot, Mr. Fenton, but if you could just try to recall anything else about the appearance of the tumor.
Lieutenant, couldn't this wait? Fenton has spent 14 horrible hours locked in a vault, and while I admire his spirit and pluck in bearing up as well as he has...
I'm just trying to get something to go on, Mr. Waterman. Do you want your money back, or don't you?
The welfare of my employees comes first, Lieutenant. First, last, and always.
And you're insured. Mr. Fenton...
Don't answer if you don't feel up to it, Fenton.
I don't mind, Mr. Waterman. I'm anxious to cooperate. Now, as near as I can remember...
Let me be sure you get this point.
As near as I can remember... Of course, I had only a flash before they forced me into the vault.
Yeah, we understand, Mr. Fenton.
I had the impression of one being tall, but not too tall, and the other one was shorter.
But not too short.
Exactly. And they were wearing masks, rubber masks. One had a Lionel Barrymore mask, and I think the other was Dick Tracy. It was quite a shock to see him.
Aha. The Brinks gang, Lieutenant. The Brinks gang to a T.
Maybe. Mr. Cartwright, would you come over here, please? Mr. Cartwright, is it the practice to keep large sums of cash on hand overnight at the store?
Well, yes. The store does a tremendous cash business, Lieutenant. Tremendous.
And yesterday was Dollar Day.
Thank you. Mr. Cartwright, how did it happen that Fenton was alone in the cash room when the bandits entered? Did he customarily close the vault for the night?
Well, not customarily, no. When I'm unavoidably called away from the store...
Well, does this happen often?
Well,
very seldom, Lieutenant. Very seldom.
But it happened yesterday. And two men walked in, put you in the vault, and walked out with a big hunk of money.
At precisely 5:56. Mr. Cartwright opened the vault this morning at 8:02.
Correct, Lieutenant. We won't know how much they got until I can make an audit.
And if there's any question, Lieutenant, of corroborating Fenton's story, I need only to say that he's been with Waterman's for 30 years, a good and faithful servant.
More exactly, Mr. Waterman, 29 years, 11 months, and 29 days. I was due to retire tomorrow before this unfortunate circumstance arose,
Nonsense, Fenton. You'll retire tomorrow. And if there's any question, Lieutenant, of Fenton's character, his honesty, his devotion...
Yeah, sure. You can go home, Mr. Fenton. Better get some rest. If you want to duck the reporters, go out this back way.
Well, what do you think, Mr. Waterman?
Entirely up to you, my boy, entirely. But in these days of doubt and confusion and dishonesty in high places, I believe your simple story of courage and devotion to duty will be an inspiration everywhere.
Mr. Waterman, I am ready to face the press. They were all very nice to me, the reporters, the police, Mr. Cartwright, and especially Mr. Waterman. All that money missing. $50,000. Yet his only concern was for me. I thought that if I could afford it, I'd like to buy him some little token of gratitude. Then I thought again. In my desk at the office, there was a secret compartment, and in that compartment was $50,000. I guess I could afford it.
Yoo-hoo! Mother,
I'm home.
Good morning, Harold. I hope you haven't had breakfast. I've kept it hot for you.
You're not going to ask me how it went, Mother?
Oh, I heard over the radio. But I wish there'd been some way of doing it, that it wouldn't have kept you out all night.
Oh, I wasn't out all night, Mother. I was in a vault.
I know you were, Harold. And if you keep on, you're going to end up with that same sinus drip your father used to have.
Oh, Mother, it was a perfectly dry, warm... Oh, never mind.
Eat your cereal, Harold. You'll feel better.
Mr. Waterman told me to take the day off, Mother. I'm not going in until tomorrow.
That was certainly big of him, after all you've done for them. How much did you get?
$50,000. It's in my desk at the office, in the drawer with the false bottom.
In your desk? Will it be safe there, Harold?
Well, no one will be looking for it.
Harold, you don't think you'll have any trouble getting the money out of your desk?
I think things will work out all right. See, according to my plan,
Harold, you see, I told you from the beginning you weren't strong enough for this type of thing.
The next morning at 8:43, I punched in at the store. Figuring 308 working days a year, that made 9,240 punches. It was a little strange to think of this being my last... I walked from the store to the elevator, past lingerie, ladies' gloves, and perfume, the way I always went. But this morning was different. People looked up when I passed. They spoke to me. They knew who I was. Even the brunette in perfume smiled at me. I almost stopped, but I couldn't think of anything to say. In the elevator, one of the girls asked me how I felt. Still scared, I said, and they laughed. They wouldn't have laughed any harder for Mr. Waterman. I got out at 8, my floor, and as I went into my office, Miss Prentice, Mr. Cartwright's secretary, looked at me. 23 months and 2 days she'd been looking at the top of my head. But this morning, she looked at me. And she smiled. I guess I smiled back.
Good morning, Mr. Fenton.
Good morning, Miss Prentice. It wasn't much, but I felt it could have been a start. I was almost sorry this was my last day.
Fenton. Fenton, did you hear me?
Yes, Mr. Cartwright. I heard you, Mr. Cartwright.
All right. A big workload piled up yesterday when you took off, and we haven't anyone new coming in till tomorrow. Not that I want to overload you on your last day.
An honest day's work for an honest day's pay, Mr. Cartwright.
Oh, good. I'm still trying to find out how much was taken in the holdup, so you're on your own.
I think I can tell you almost to the penny, Mr. Cartwright.
I'll make my own check. Now about the work Oh, good morning, Mr. Waterman. I was just,
Well, Fenton, back at the old desk, eh? Well,
I just didn't feel right away from it, Mr. Waterman.
Hey, I got a surprise for you this afternoon, Fenton. Going to make a little ceremony out of your retirement.
A ceremony?
Good for store morale. Right, Cartwright?
Oh, absolutely, Mr. Waterman, absolutely.
And about that request of yours you made last week, Fenton, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if we can swing it.
Oh, you're too kind, Mr. Waterman.
Oh, my boy, when you work for Waterman's 30 years, you've got something coming to you.
No. Really? I ate my usual lunch that day, the Thursday Blue Plate Special at Elmo's Grotto. 70 cents plus the usual 10% tip. 7 cents. With the usual 20 minutes left in my lunch hour, I headed for the park with a nickel bag of peanuts. The squirrels were going to miss me. No, no, Mr. Waterman. You've had 3 already. Give Mr. Cartwright a chance. Sit up, Mr. Cartwright. Sit. That's it. That's it.
Excuse me. Would you mind if I join you, Mr. Fenton?
Why, Miss Prentice. Of course. I mean, of course not. Sit down, sit down.
Thank you.
Move over, Mr. Waterman.
He does look a little pompous, doesn't he? Which one is Mr. Cartwright?
There, with the small mustache. He bites.
And, is there a Miss Prentice?
Well, there is, but I believe she is, well...
Nesting?
Well.
How long have you been feeding them, Mr. Fenton? They seem so friendly.
30 years, Miss Prentice. My favorite animal. You give a squirrel a nut, and does he eat it? No. He runs away and stores it in a hole. We could all benefit from their example.
And now that you've stored your little nest egg, you're retiring, Mr. Fenton.
Well, you might say that, yes.
You're quite a fascinating character, Mr. Fenton.
Me?
I'm sorry I didn't know you sooner. You know, the whole store is talking about your ordeal in that vault.
Oh, it wasn't so bad. In fact, I've always rather liked the vault.
What an odd thing to say.
Well, chacun est so goût, Miss Prentice. That's French for each to his own taste.
Oh, you've been abroad, Mr. Fenton.
Me? Oh, my goodness, no.
Oh, but you will now that you're retiring.
No, no, I've got my eye on a little cottage by a lake and woods. Lots of squirrels there. And no time clock.
You and your wife?
Mother.
Oh, I hope you get it, Mr. Fenton.
Thank you, Miss Prentice.
I wonder what the robbers are going to do with all that money.
I wonder. 5-1. Shall we go back and punch in, Miss Prentice? She let me walk all the way back to the store with her. And in the elevator, Mr. Bixler, sporting goods, winked at me. Funny, for 10 years I'd had the feeling Mr. Bixler didn't like me. There was quite a gathering in the cashier's office when we arrived. All the executives from Mr. Waterman's down, and the editor of the store paper wandering through Waterman's. I'd sent an item to him last summer, Mr. Fenton of Cashier's Department spending his 2-week vacation at home, but he never printed it.
Well, come in, Fenton. We've been waiting for our, shall we say, guest of honor.
Me, Mr. Waterman?
You, Fenton. We have a little ceremony which I'd hope to conclude before the lunch hour was over.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Waterman.
Think nothing of it. This is your day, Fenton, your day. Oh, going to get a shot of the two of us, Wool?
Yes, sir, Mr. Waterman. Over by the door.
Oh, if you don't mind, I'd like it sitting at my desk. I feel more, well, secure there.
By your desk. How's this? Got it? Good, good. And now, Fenton,
we all say farewell to a good and faithful servant, one who has given 30 years of his life as a contribution, however small, to making Waterman's the great institution it is today. Well done, Harold Fenton.
Thank you.
A modest man, but conscientious. His regular comings and goings passed almost unknown to many until his ordeal of 2 days ago. Locked all night in the vault by brutal and rapacious thieves. A night in which, in his own words, he relived each and every day of his 30-year service to Waterman's. Oh, greater devotion hath no man.
Oh, it was nothing, really.
And now, his labor's done, his burden borne, Fenton will live up the rest of his days in ease and comfort, because he has arrived at the retirement age of the Waterman pension plan, by which he will receive
$31.68 a month.
$31.68 a month, for as long as he lives.
Thank you.
And now, a little surprise for Harold Fenton. A week ago, in a letter to me, our good and faithful servant asked that on his retirement he be given permission to purchase for his home his old desk.
Well, actually, Mr. Waterman, I don't know what I'd do without it.
Well, frankly, I put in a lot of thought on this simple request.
Hmm?
I weighed the factors in my mind. On the one hand was Fenton's 30-year service. On the other...
Mr. Waterman.
On the other, he was already receiving his pension of, his pension. However...
Please, Mr. Waterman.
However, Fenton, my boy, I decided to go you one better.
One better? Not a new desk.
Nothing so unsentimental. Fenton, instead of allowing you to purchase the desk, I'm giving it to you.
Phew.
All right, boys, right in here. Take the desk wherever Fenton here wants it. And now, back to work, everybody. Month-end clearance today.
Whoops. Easy, man. Don't drop it. Easy.
Fenton, my boy, in the years ahead, when you're seated at your old desk, think of us, won't you?
I certainly will, Mr. Waterman. I certainly will. Retirement agreed with me. A walk to the park to see my friends when I felt like it. Leisurely lunch at Elmo's Grotto when I felt like it. And when the need arose, a little gardening. Mother and I were very happy.
You've done enough for one morning, Harold. Your back will go out again.
All through, Mother. Just cleaning off the spade.
What were you planting this morning, Harold?
Mother, if anything should happen to me, knock wood.
Knock wood?
Right in between the beets and the radishes, there's a very rich patch of dirt.
Son, aren't we going to get our little cottage by the lake?
I have to go in town today, Mother. I might just inquire around.
Oh, good.
You know, Mr. Waterman is really a very sweet man. The Waterman pension plan. I just wish I could tell him how happy it's made me. I hadn't told Mother, but Miss Prentice had called that morning. Mr. Cartwright wanted to see me that afternoon at the office, she said. And she asked how I was. What would have happened if I'd asked her to lunch? I almost did, too. In the cashier's office at the store, Miss Prentice smiled when she saw me, and I smiled back. In fact, we struck up quite a conversation.
Oh, Mr. Fenton, how are you?
Fine. Just fine, Miss Prentice.
Retirement agree with you?
Yes, yes, indeed. Fine.
You notice we haven't filled your old job.
No? Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
Haven't been able to find another man of your type. Well?
Is
that you, Fenton? Come on in here.
Coming. Coming, Mr. Cartwright.
Sit down, Fenton. Sit down.
Thank you.
Just trying to clean up accounts on the robbery. Fenton, what was your final tally again?
$50,000, almost exactly, Mr. Cartwright.
You're way off. That doesn't check with my audit at all.
I'm quite sure of my figure.
Well, then you're wrong, that's all. My check shows they got away with $82,000.
$82,000?
Right. Now, if you'll just sign the necessary statements corroborating my audit...
I can't do that, Mr. Cartwright.
And just why can't you? Don't you take my word for it?
Frankly, no.
Fenton, look. You're retired. It's nothing to you one way or the other. You just made a little mistake in your figures, that's all.
Mr. Cartwright, are you asking me to help cover up a shortage in your accounts?
All right, Fenton, I'll lay it on the line. Temporarily, I'm a bit short. Involvement with a woman and... you wouldn't understand.
I most certainly wouldn't.
Look, I'll make it worth your while.
Shortages are found out sooner or later, Mr. Cartwright.
All right, if that's your attitude, let me tell you something, Fenton. I don't like the smell of this robbery of yours. I don't like it at all. What do you think of that?
You're implying that I made off with $50,000 belonging to Waterman's?
I think it's highly possible. And how are you so sure it was $50,000?
Supposing me, for one instant, capable of such a thing, Mr. Cartwright. Wouldn't I be much too clever to put my head in a noose by covering up for you?
Fenton, if I was talking to an honest man, wouldn't he have taken my story right to Mr. Waterman? I'll give you 5 minutes. Either sign my audit or I go to the police and accuse you of stealing $82,000. Think it over, Fenton.
No question about it, Mr. Cartwright's dishonesty might be a bit awkward for me. My instinct about the man had been thoroughly sound. I had disliked him for 16 years. Well, there was only one safe way out of it.
Well?
Mr. Cartwright, if you need money...
Yes?
Why don't you rob the vault? Actually, it isn't hard at all.
Well, how do I get away with the money?
I'm sorry, I never reveal professional secrets.
Well, then you'll have to help me, Fenton. Lock me in the vault and you get away with the money.
Me?
Sure. Then we're both in the clear for good. Help me out, Fenton.
You mean I'm going to clear out the vault a second time?
You'll never regret it.
Regret it? The fact is, I'd rather enjoy it. We settled on the following Friday. Friday nights, the store stayed open till 9, and they were having a big white sale that day. The money was already stacked on Mr. Cartwright's desk when I got there. It was a juicy haul. I didn't see Mr. Cartwright around, but...
Hello, Mr. Fenton.
Miss Prentice. But the money...
I was listening when you and Mr. Cartwright made your plans, Mr. Fenton, and he caught me and forced me to help him. You understand, Harold. I mean, Mr. Fenton.
Harold, times like these draw people together quickly, don't you think?
Oh, I do. I really do.
Miss Prentice.
Helen.
Thank you. Helen, Miss Prentice, Mr. Cartwright mentioned a woman in his life. You're not the one?
Harold, of course not.
Excuse me. I just thought... You remember the office party last Christmas?
Oh, that? Well, that was just because he was under the mistletoe. And if you'd been under it instead of Mr. Cartwright...
Really? Well...
Oh, Fenton, you're here. Good. Anybody see you come up?
It doesn't matter, really, Mr. Cartwright. Might even be better that way. Then you and Miss Prentice can say that I left minutes before the bandits arrived.
You're right, of course, Harold.
Thank you. Are you ready, Mr. Cartwright? I brought some wrapping paper for the money. Even brought along a handle with care sticker. That's the Fenton touch, you know.
Get on with it, will you?
No need to be nervous. There. Neat? I spent 8 years in wrapping and mailing.
All right. You know what to do with it, Helen.
I know.
Just a minute, Mr. Cartwright. I'm to take the money, remember?
There's been a change, Fenton. We rewrote the script.
You think that's wise? To fly in the face of my experience?
Now look, Fenton, we're not children. You lock us in the vault and take off with the money. You think we'd ever see you again?
Well, you're questioning my honesty? I'm sure Miss Prentice will vouch for me. We're rather good friends. Miss Prentice. Helen.
Unfortunately for you, Fenton, Helen's on my side. Now, if you wouldn't mind getting into the vault,
me?
Huh?
Me? In the vault? But...
This is a loaded gun, Fenton. Get in the vault.
But...
You came back for a second helping, that's all. Your Confederate got away with the money, but I courageously slammed the vault door on you and went for help.
But...
Will they believe me? I imagine they'll find $50,000 somewhere around your house. They'll believe me.
Helen. I see.
I'm sorry, Harold. It's a nasty trick, but we're nasty people. You should have stuck to squirrels.
Just one thing, Fenton. How did you ever get that $50,000 out of here the first time?
How? Well, I didn't, Mr. Cartwright.
You didn't?
Then where is it?
It's still in the vault.
I don't believe it.
Oh, it's quite cleverly hidden. It took me most of that night. I was locked in.
Get in there and show me.
I'm sorry, Mr. Cartwright.
Get in there!
No. I went through a lot for that money, Mr. Cartwright. 30 years. I just as soon you shot me.
Helen, hold the gun on him. I'm going in and look.
Well, don't be long. What if somebody should walk in?
I'll be able to see if he's lying. Just watch him.
You see anything?
Not yet. I don't think it's possible that... Open the door so I can get some more light.
Must be true. Crime changes people. I had never lied, yet I lied to Cartwright. I had never used violence, Yet I got behind Helen and...
Hey!
I guess I'll go home. Mother will be wondering what's happened to me.
Some more cereal, Harold?
I don't think so, Mother, thanks. What time is it?
8:10, son.
Well, they would have opened the vault at 8 this morning. The police should be here any minute.
Are you sure those two will implicate you, Harold?
It seems likely, Mother. The gun would be hard to explain. And I think Miss Prentice will turn on Mr. Cartwright after a night in the vault.
Yes, she's just the type.
I'm sorry, Mother. I guess I just don't know much about women.
It's all right, son. You think they'll be hard on you?
Not very. I haven't spent any of the money. The insurance companies always look kindly on such cases. There they are.
Harold! How long?
2 years, Mother. Maybe less. Maybe even one.
It's still a long time.
A long time? After 30 years in Waterman's? Hardly. I'll get the door.
Suspense is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis, with music composed by Lucian Morowick and conducted by Lud Gluskin. A Good and Faithful Servant was written for Suspense by Richard M. Powell. Portions of this program were transcribed. In tonight's cast, Norma Varden was heard as Mrs. Fenton, Doris Singleton as Helen, Gerald Moore as Mr. Cartwright, Joseph Kearns as Mr. Waterman, Hi Everback as Lieutenant Miller, and Charles Calvert as Mr. Wolfe.
This is the CBS Radio Network.
Strange Adventure. George Mellaby and his companion, the Dutch hunter Hans de Groot, sat before their tent on the edge of the Kalahari Desert. The geologist Mellaby explained his theory to the hunter de Groot.
Now, the Orange River and its tributaries run through a great tract of diamond-bearing territory. This has been going on for ages. All this time, the rivers have been gouging out diamonds along with the other pebbles, and the current has been rushing them downstream.
But they must have stayed on the bottom, eh?
Oh, many of them, yes. But many were washed downstream until they eventually reached the estuary and South Atlantic.
And then all one would have to do is to go to the mouth of the Orange River and just fill his pockets with diamonds, eh?
Oh, it's not as easy as that. The sea washed them back somewhere along the coast. Yes, I'm counting on science to help me find the beach of diamonds.
Day followed weary day as the two white men and their small safari worked their way across the wild, trackless territory. De Groot became filled with an insatiable desire to find the beach of diamonds and claim its untold wealth for himself. One morning, Mellaby awoke to find the other white man gone. Gone also were many of his native bears and most of the supplies. The hunter had deserted him. The scientist followed the Orange River down to the ocean. Then he started trekking up the coast. The whole country was like a part of a dead world. His pack animals died. All his natives deserted him except Mbangi, his faithful head boy. The wind lashed at them. The sand drove at them like millions of tiny arrows. Water ran out, and they could find no more. At last, Mellaby and Mbangi climbed a little rise that overlooked Alexander Bay. The men stared out across the bare open beach. The blinding sun came out through a rift in the clouds and shone on the pebbles of the beach. The pebbles glittered.
Mbangi, look! Those pebbles, they're diamonds. We've found the beach of diamonds.
Yes, Bath. We find beach of diamonds. Now can we rest?
All right, Mbangi. Make camp in the lee of that sand dune.
Mellaby ran down the beach picking up the shiny pebbles. He thought of de Groot, the greedy hunter who had robbed him, and wondered what had happened to the Dutchman. A bullet kicked up the sand near the feet of the geologist. He dropped to the beach more surprised than frightened. A man came into sight over the top of one of the dunes.
My friend Mellaby. At last we meet again, Nigmar. You were so very good to lead me to the beach.
De Groot, how did you...
It was very easy. I backtracked and came upon your trail. I merely followed you.
The Dutchman leveled his rifle at the unarmed scientist.
It is too bad. Diamond Beach will become your tomb.
Mellaby saw a tall figure appear at the top of the dune. A hunting spear flashed through the air. De Groot fell impaled by the barb and rolled down the shifting side of the sand dune dead. Mbangi smiled at his master.
But he bad man. He had no use for Beach of Diamonds.
Mellaby took his stones back to Johannesburg. As soon as the Diamond Corporation learned of his discovery, he was given a check for $10 million. This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye from my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of Strange Adventure.
Well, this brings us to our first break. Hey, I'm sorry, but I gotta do it. Look, I'm just gonna play some music, okay? I'm pretty fond of Quiet Please. The combination of Willis Cooper as producer and very frequently writer of the scripts and Ernest Chappell as principal actor produced some absolutely stellar material. The writing is tight, concise, and often intense. And Ernest Chappell's performances are occasionally legendary. And I cannot think of a more idiomatic and haunting theme than the slow, beautiful strands of Caesar Franck's Symphony in D Minor that opened the program. The only real problem with Quiet Please is that most of the surviving episodes, and there are a lot of surviving episodes, are taken from very scratchy old 78 recordings. The audio quality is pretty much uniformly terrible. And my own expertise with cleaning up these old recordings is way past limited. Still, I do the best I can, as I have with the episode tonight, which was the seventh episode of Quiet Please, with a story written by Willis Cooper. Oh, and I nearly forgot. I was going to mention, and will mention, that if you want, there's a website called genericradioscripts.com, which actually has the script for this program that you can read along if you want. The way you would find this would be to go to the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, look in segment 2, and at the very bottom, there'll be a link to this very script.
Quiet, please.
Okay, I'll shut up now.
Quiet, please.
And directed by Willis Cooper and featuring Ernest Chappell is called Inquest.
My name is William Ross, and I want to know why I'm here.
My dear Mr. Ross, in all cases of violent death, it is customary for an inquest to be held. Surely you know that, don't you?
Well, who are those people?
The jury, Mr. Ross. And if you are wondering, my office is that of Carlos. Now, may we proceed, please?
Well, now, wait a minute. I want to know what these people are wearing those funny clothes for. They look more like a masquerade than a coroner's jury.
You are referring to the gentleman in kilt?
Him and the others, too. Well, who is he?
Will you identify yourself to Mr. Ross, please, sir?
My name is Duncan.
What's the idea of the scotch outfit?
Sir, I'm a scot. These are my usual garments.
Thank you, sir. You may be seated again, Mr. Ross.
I think it's a funny outfit to wear at a coroner's inquest.
Your garments may be quite as unusual to some of the members of the jury as theirs are to you, Mr. Ross.
I must look pretty funny, then.
That is a matter of opinion, Mr. Ross. Shall we begin?
I want counsel.
That will not be necessary, sir. This is not a court of law, but an inquiring body whose function it is to determine the causes of death in the case.
Yeah, you find it was justifiable homicide, brother. I'm telling you.
We shall see. You were on bad terms with your sister and your brother-in-law?
They were on bad terms with me.
I see. This is a state of affairs that has existed for some time.
Long enough.
How long?
Since before she married him.
And they were married?
Just a few months. They've been married just a few months when this thing happened.
When the murder was done. We call things by their right names here, Mr. Ross.
And you haven't proved anything yet.
We shall.
You find it was self-defense.
All in good time, Mr. Ross.
Now, you see. Go ahead. Go ahead, ask me questions.
Very well. You'll tell the truth, the whole truth.
And nothing but the truth. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Sure.
I regret that it is impossible for us to call your sister and your brother-in-law as witnesses. So we shall have to depend upon your testimony completely.
Sure, yeah. I know.
Perhaps you can tell the jury something about the causes behind this ill feeling between you and your sister, Mr. Ross.
I certainly can.
Do so, please.
Well, it's pretty simple. Eileen was born in 1908, 2 years before me. There were just the two of us.
I understand your parents were wealthy, Mr. Ross.
Yes, they were. That's part of it, too.
I suspect it. Go on.
I haven't got any money. So what's he laughing at?
None of the people who come here to testify ever have any money, Mr. Ross, for one reason or another.
Well, that's not funny.
I agree with you, Mr. Ross. Kindly refrain from unseemly mirth, gentlemen. Go on, sir.
Well, our parents were drowned in the wreck of the vessel. When was that, 1927?
1928.
Yeah, that's right, 28. They left everything to us, quite a lot of money.
Yes.
But there was a catch to it.
Address the jury, Mr. Ross.
What? Well, I said there was a catch in it. We weren't to get all the money right away. We were both underage, you see. Eileen was 20 and I was 18.
Will you speak up, please?
All right. We got $5,000 a year at first. And we were to get the rest of our shares when we came of age.
That was a considerable amount, Mr. Ross?
It was. So I was supposed to wait 3 years. Eileen got hers the next year, in 1929. I had to wait.
Did you wait, Mr. Ross?
Yes. Well, I waited till Eileen got her share. I mean, after all, it was our money. It wasn't fair for Eileen to have that much and me not have a cent. Was it?
We're not here to judge such things, Mr. Ross. This is a coroner's jury.
Well, you see what I mean.
Go on, sir.
So I saw people making money that year hand over fist. All you needed to make money was the money to start with. And I didn't have any.
What about your 5,000?
I lost that.
Gentlemen.
Well, I borrowed money from her. I mean, I didn't borrow it either. I showed her how I could make a lot more money for her by just investing her money.
But I don't want any more money, William.
I told her if I had my money, I'd put it into investments and double it or triple it. And she just smiled at me. She had the most aggravating smile I've ever seen. No matter what I'd say, she'd shake her head and smile at me.
Was that when you forged her name, Mr. Ross?
I don't think that's for you.
Well, of course, I'm no judge. You promised to speak the truth, you know, Mr. Ross.
Well, I signed her name to a bank draft, sure. I was doing her a favor. I was going to make a lot of money for her.
Of course.
And I was going to have my money in another couple of years. There wasn't anything wrong with that. After all, we were brother and sister. And it wasn't my fault the market crashed. Was it?
Of course not, Mr. Ross.
Well, of course it wasn't.
For the record, Mr. Ross, how much did she lose?
All her money. Well, not all of it right away. There was about $65,000 on the draft, you see, but when the market started to slip, there was margin that we had to get up, you see. I explained to her in words of one syllable how if we didn't put up margin, we'd lose everything we'd invested. Well, that's where the rest of it went.
Of course, you couldn't put up your own.
How could I? It was tied up in government bonds and things like that for another year. I couldn't touch it. I explained that to her.
And she was still unreasonable.
Well, I should say she was.
A despicable thief.
Call me names.
Get out of here and never come back.
Tried to throw me out of her house.
Not even a place to live.
She changed her tune when I pointed out she didn't have a house to throw me out of, though. Oh, brother. Oh, was that a battle.
That was when she, when her arm was broken?
Well, how did I know she was going to fall down? I just gave her a little push, pushed her away from me.
Women are so delicate. It's too bad, though, really, that her arm was permanently deformed.
Yes, yeah, certainly was. But is that my fault? I offered not once but a dozen times to take her to a doctor and have the arm rebroken and set again. Could have been done very easy, just re-break it and set it again. But what did she do?
Tell us, Mr. Ross, you received your share of the estate, all right?
Oh, sure, sure. And you want to know something else? Just as soon as I got hold of my money, I...
You didn't reimburse your sister.
I did better than that. I took her in to live with me at my new house. I didn't charge her a cent.
She didn't have any money to pay you, did she?
No, but I let her be a kind of, you know, a housekeeper, you see. I thought it'd make her feel better if she, you know, sort of earned her keep.
I have no doubt.
And she had money whenever she wanted it, brother. She never had to ask me for a dime. Every week when I gave her the house money, there was always something extra for her. $5, $5, $10, $20 sometimes. She had no kick coming.
Well, then I take it you feel she had no real reason to harbor a grudge against you.
I don't see why she should. But she did.
Amazing.
Well, I take that back. I guess she did have an excuse for a grudge. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess she did. You know, about Arthur.
Arthur.
The guy she married.
Your brother.
No, that's right. Oh, that jerk. I didn't like him from the start.
Well, naturally, you did your best to prevent her marriage.
Well, I was just thinking of her. What's your name?
Why, I'm the coroner, Mr. Ross. Don't you remember? This is an inquest.
Yes, but you must have a name. I can't just call you coroner, can I? Haven't you got a name?
Oh, yes, I have a name, Mr. Ross. We'll get to that. In the meantime, the jury is waiting to hear the rest of your testimony.
Oh, yes, the jury. I thought there were only supposed to be 6 people on a coroner's jury. There's more than 6 people over there.
Oh, yes. Well,
those fellows in the masquerade costume. Listen, coroner, what's the idea of all that? Looks awful phony to me.
Well, I assure you it's anything but phony, Mr. Ross.
You sure this is a coroner's jury? Not some gag you're rigging up to make me confess?
Confess what, Mr. Ross?
Well, I mean, make me talk.
You are talking, Mr. Ross.
It's like a convention of a lunatic asylum. That Scotchman.
Scotchman, Mr. Ross.
Scotchman, and that fellow there in the bathrobe.
But they're the coroner's jury, Mr. Ross, I told you.
Never heard of people dressing up like that just to be on a coroner's jury.
This is your first experience with such a body, isn't it, Mr. Ross?
It certainly is.
Well, then we can forgive you for being unfamiliar with our procedure. Now, shall we get on with our inquest?
Well, this is on the up and up.
I assure you it is, sir. You said you objected to your sister's marriage.
I did?
Why?
For her own good. Here she was living in luxury.
Luxury?
What? I'd call it luxury for somebody who didn't have a cent to her name, Mr. Coroner. She had a good home, her own room with a private bath even. She could use my car practically whenever she wanted to. She had good clothes. Where would she have been without me?
I was thinking of that.
I'll tell you where she'd have been. She'd have been in some charitable institution. Or she'd have been scrubbing floors or something.
Or she might have been... Well, that's not the answer.
Yeah, that's right. And so this Arthur came along. And she falls for him.
I love him.
God, I detested on such.
I love him.
A guy with no more money than she had.
I love him.
I told her flatly I wouldn't take him into my house.
We're not asking that, William. He'll be all
right. Said she'd be all right. How could she be all right? What would they live on?
You took my money and lost it, William.
Wanted me to give her money.
You stole my money.
Called me a thief.
She wouldn't need much.
I wouldn't give her a cent. I gave her a home. I took care of her. I'd have got that crooked arm of hers fixed up. Why, with that arm, she couldn't even do the housework decently. And then she has that crust to want me to set her and this Arthur of hers up in their own home. Support them, even.
Where did Arthur come from, Mr. Ross? Did you know him before?
Yeah, he was in the army. I didn't know.
You weren't in the army, Mr. Ross.
No, I had a bad heart, you know.
Yes, I know.
I bought plenty of war bonds, though. Every week, $18.75, regular as clockwork. It is Arthur. He didn't buy war bonds. He was in the army. Not that the army wasn't all right, but some of the people they had in it.
Isn't there something about taking all kinds of people to make a world, Mr. Ross? I suppose that applies to army, too.
Yeah, I suppose it does. But I don't want any part of that kind.
What was your objection to him?
Well, to begin with, he wanted to take my sister away from me. That was enough to set me against him. Then he didn't have any job or any prospects. And he didn't like me.
I can't understand that.
I wasn't going to have him upset my way of living. After all, I'd had Eileen there with me for, well, let's see, it was nearly 15 years. I was used to her.
Hadn't you ever had any idea of getting married yourself, Mr. Rose?
Me? I should say not. Why should I?
Yeah, I suppose you're right. After all, you had a housekeeper, someone you were used to. And I understand you were quite a ladies' man, too. Marriage might upset that much.
Yeah, it certainly would.
Well, now, Mr. Ross, we have the background to this unfortunate occurrence, haven't we? Shall we get down to details now, if you're ready?
I'm all ready. Go ahead. Go on, ask me questions.
I think we'd all rather have you tell the story in your own words, without prompt.
Well, say, listen.
Yes, Mr. Ross.
I didn't see all those other people before.
What other people?
I thought an inquest was a private thing. I didn't know you had an audience. Do I have to make a spectacle of myself in front of all those people?
Which people, Mr. Ross?
Those people back there behind your jury. There's a shadow back there. There's millions of them, far as I can see. Who are they?
Oh, those people.
Yeah, who are they?
The people listening to you on the radio.
Radio? Are we on the radio?
Didn't you know, Mr. Ross?
Well, I certainly did not.
Oh, that's bad.
Well, I never heard of a coroner's inquest like this.
You said this is your first experience.
Yes, but
we're wasting time, Mr. Ross.
Well, what am I supposed to do?
We want to hear your story.
I've told it to you.
Not all of it. Come, Mr. Ross.
Listen.
Come, Mr. Ross.
Come where?
Over here to this microphone.
I won't do it.
Oh, yes, but you will.
I'm not going to talk to all those people.
Yes, you are. Stand up, Mr. Ross.
You've got my rights, you know.
We are very considerate of your rights. Just step this way. Now, if you please, Mr. Ross. Right here. You can speak into this microphone so the audience will hear you clear.
I'm not going
not
to...
not so close to the microphone. Now, so we will hear your story of that day. We shall supply you with sound effects if they are necessary. And we even have music for you to put you in the mood.
Well, I don't know what kind of monkey business this is.
An inquest, Mr. Ross. Simply an inquest at which you are the principal witness. You're on your own, Mr. Ross. A great many people are listening. Music, please. Go ahead, Mr. Ross.
Well, I told Eileen I wouldn't let her marry this Arthur. I told you that, didn't I? After all, I've taken care of Eileen for all those years. And I think it's very unfair of her to want to walk out on me after all I've done for her. got a good home. And you have to remember that she's a cripple. With that crooked arm of hers, what could she do? What kind of wife would she make? And she's 39 years old now. That's too old to start in married life. And this fellow out there is nearly... He's nearly 10 years younger than she is. Not only that, but how is he going to make a living for her? Sure, he was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. He got a lot of medals. He was a Japanese prisoner and all that. But lieutenant colonels are a dime a dozen now. And he's got no money. There are no prospects. He probably thinks Eileen's got money. He thinks he's going to get some of that. Well, Eileen, you know, hasn't got any money. It's my money. And she isn't going to get a cent of it. Unless I die before she does. And a small prospect of that. So get out, Arthur, I said. Get out and stay out. And Eileen, you see that he stays out of my house. That's what I said. And I meant it. Well, he went. Eileen cried. Eileen is always crying. What's that? What's that noise?
That's a sound effect, Mr. Bowen. Perhaps you'd better listen to it a moment.
Sounds like Eileen crying.
Listen, Mr. Ross.
I won't give you up, Arthur. I won't.
Can't be Eileen. You said that...
A sound effect, Mr. Ross. Listen.
Oh, but Arthur, how can we? He's got to help him.
Isn't there some way we can talk to him
and do something? Darling, if he won't let me have some of the money he stole from me, how can we? Oh, I hate him. I hate him.
Did you recognize our sound effects, Mr. Ross?
I don't know how you did that.
Well, that isn't important, Mr. Ross. You did recognize it, didn't you?
Certainly I did. That was 3 weeks ago. That was the day that... Well, that was the day I really went into action.
You remember?
I came into the room. Eileen was sitting with her back to me. She didn't see me. Arthur was facing me. Eileen didn't hear me come in the room, and of course he couldn't see me.
Perhaps you'd better explain to our radio audience why Arthur didn't see you, Mr. Ross, if he was facing you.
Well, sure. Didn't I say he was blind? I walked right up to them before he saw me. Hate me, I said, And she jumped up in front of me. I'll show you, I said, and I reached out for him. He got to his feet and he was turning his head looking for me, but he couldn't see me. I grabbed him by the collar. I'll show you, I said, and she leaped at me. See those marks on my face? Her fingernails. And she kept screaming.
Hate you, hate you, hate you!
He got an arm around her and he tried to pull her away.
Don't.
And I started pushing him toward the door and she grabbed up a heavy ashtray and struck at me with it.
And you grabbed her arm?
Well, I couldn't help it if it was her bad arm, could I?
Of course not, Mr. Ross. And of course, Arthur couldn't see you.
How could he? He was making passes in the air trying to find me.
And you knocked him down.
And threw him out. Next time I'll kill you, I said.
You shouldn't have said that, you know, Mr. Ross.
I know.
It could be used against you.
Well, I had to protect myself. Well, all right. I figured I'd fix that. I got the doctor for Eileen. She wasn't hurt bad. She just fainted when her arm got twisted. And she wouldn't speak to me. Stayed in her room. That house was an inch deep in dust. Dishes weren't washed. No groceries. Wouldn't come out of her room. I was pretty sore. I've got a violent temper, you know. I don't brood about things. I do something about them. Well, I let her stay in her room. And then finally I got tired of it. I went upstairs one morning with blood in my eye. I hammered on her door. I said, open up that door, Eileen! There wasn't any answer. I hammered some more. She still didn't answer, and I said, Eileen, open up that door, I'll break it down! I said, I'll take the cost of fixing it out of your allowance, too! There still wasn't any answer, so I got back and I slammed my shoulder against it, and then the second time, the lock broke and I fell into the room.
And she wasn't there.
That's right. She wasn't there.
But the note was.
That's right. The note. She'd skipped out on me. She'd married that Arthur. That blind man. I thought I'd die right then and there.
You didn't, though.
No, but I thought I was going to. When I found she got into my safe, I'd forgotten she knew the combination.
How much was missing?
$15,000 in bonds. She stole it.
How much did you get from her that other time?
Well, that was different. This was stealing.
I see.
Well, I hunted high and low for her. I hired detectives, and they cost plenty, too. I didn't find her. I thought they'd be easy to find a blind man and a woman with a crooked arm, but they weren't. I used to lie awake nights thinking of what I'd do to them when I found them.
You're making some very damaging statements, Mr. Oh,
I am. So what? We'll see whether it was justifiable homicide or what. Well, they came back. I was all alone. They knew I'd be alone.
Was that the day, Mr. Ross?
Yeah, that's right. They came in. Eileen still had her key. I didn't know they were there till she spoke from the doorway of the living room.
We'd come back.
And he was with her, standing, grinning behind her in the hall. Grinning, he thought, at me, at his new brother-in-law. His face was turned in the wrong direction. Blind men give me the creeps. She came in the room and she put out her hands to me and she smiled.
Aren't you going to congratulate us?
And my head began to swim and the light in the room seemed to turn red and I staggered as I got up out of the chair and then she backed away from me and I heard him talking dimly.
William, what's the matter?
The room began whirling around faster and I tried to speak but I just got, well, I got kind of mumbled and Eileen yelled.
William!
And I reached for that fool Arthur's throat. Yes, I did. Listen to me. As I reached for his throat, I saw Eileen out of the corner of my eye, and she was picking up an old-fashioned dirk that was on a coffee table that used to belong to my grandfather. We used it for a paper knife. She was running at me, and I was trying to hold on to Arthur, and she stabbed at me, and I couldn't let go of him because he was struggling, and she cut my hand. Didn't I tell you it was self-defense? And she kept striking at me, and I grabbed the dirk out of her hand, and Arthur was kicking me, and I got the dirk, and I heard Eileen scream, and there was a great red flash in my mind, and well, that's all. So, that's the story, Mr. Coroner. Next thing I remember is sitting in that chair over there with your jury and your radio audience staring at me. So, go on, let's hear your verdict. Go on, let's hear it from your masquerade party jury. Go on!
Very well, Mr. Ross. Your Majesty?
Majesty? What's this?
King Duncan of Scotland is foreman of our jury, Mr. Ross.
There isn't any King
Duncan. If you will please to remember, Mr. Ross, Duncan of Scotland was foully murdered by a certain Macbeth many the long year ago.
Yes, Mr. Ross. And the gentleman in what you term the bathrobe died at the hand of a friend named Rufus.
And the gentleman in the red cap was done to death by a slip of a girl named Charlotte Corday in 1794.
What are you talking about, you...
Yes, Mr. Ross, these gentlemen are your peers. All murder victims at one time or another.
What kind of a masquerade?
I assure you, this is no masquerade. Just one thing. Your sister and your brother-in-law did not die.
Well, then, what's all this about?
Your Majesty, the verdict, if you please.
Guilty of murder, Mr. Coroner.
Murder? But you said they didn't die.
No, Mr. Ross. They didn't. But you did. Your heart, remember? And now I think you are my property.
You have listened to Inquest. A Quiet Please story written and directed by Willis Cooper. The man who spoke to you was Ernest Chappell.
And James Van Dyke played the coroner. King Malcolm was Pat O'Malley. Eileen was played by Sylvia Cole. And Arthur was John Morley. Music was composed and played by Gene Carrazzo. And so, until next week, I am quietly yours, Curtis Chapel.
This program came to you from New York. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Well, we're going to take a bit of a break right now, but we'll be back very soon with X minus one. Next up is an episode of X minus one, which, to tell the truth, could be kind of uneven. Nevertheless, it is considered to be the finest science fiction drama ever produced for radio. Following, not exactly on the tails of, but fairly close after Dimension X, it began its run in 1955, airing adaptations of recently published stories, usually from Galaxy Science Fiction magazine, written by some of the best science fiction writers of the time, people like Philip K. Dick and J.T. McIntosh, Bob Einman, Ted Sturgeon. It is still very fondly remembered. Today we have the story of Martian Sam, baseball player extraordinary, from April the 3rd of 1957.
Countdown for blast-off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Tonight, an original story by Ernest Canoy. The time, early in the 21st century. The story, Martian Sam.
The whole thing started the first day of spring training. I'd gotten into camp 2 or 3 days before and started to loosen up a little. Because at my age, even batting fungos to an outfielder can tie your muscles up into knots. Although, as a matter of fact, I'd bet that I was in better condition than half the Humpty Dumpties on the club. We hadn't won a pennant since, 1997 or was it 98? And it looked like we had a permanent lease on 12th place. The Los Angeles Dodgers were in pretty sad shape, and that's the honest truth. I was standing behind the batting cage watching a couple of kids from our Tokyo farm team when Tommy Watson, and the New York Times Tribune News, caught me by the elbow.
Hi, Joe. Well, how does it look this spring?
Well, Tommy, the club has been considerably improved.
Mm-hmm.
Several of the youngsters are ready to deliver this year, and, of course, we expect sterling performances from our veterans. Is that what you want?
Oh, come on now, Joe, come off it. Has old man Castle loosened up enough to buy a catcher?
Not that I know of.
Well, how about a left-handed pitcher?
Well, they're those two boys from Tokyo.
Oh, come on. They couldn't throw a cream puff across the dining room table. Well, how does it feel to be first base coach for a team that'll clinch last place by July 4th?
You're very kind, Tommy. Very kind.
I just hate to see that old tightwad Castle run this club into the ground. I remember my father used to tell me about the times way back when they were still in Brooklyn. Yeah, and I can remember going down to Robinson Stadium when I was a kid to watch doubleheaders with the Denver Giants. Now look at them. A bunch of overage bums and a few kids who could hardly make the high school team. And all Castle's money goes to buy sports rockets for that screwball son of his. Oh, Joe, baseball isn't what it used to be.
The sad truth of the matter was that Tommy was putting it mild. Old man Castle, the owner, begrudged every nickel that was spent on the ball club. I don't think anybody had gotten a raise in the last 5 years. The manager was old Rabbit Cinadella, and Castle used to issue statements every year about how he had great faith in him. Truth of the matter was that Rabbit would work for less than any other manager this side of the Sally League. You'll see what I mean when I tell you that the club traveled in an old four-jet strato rocket like some barnstorming semi-pro team. I was in the locker room looking down at my feet to avoid looking around at what passed for ball players on this Los Angeles Dodgers when Rabbit came up to me.
Joe.
Yeah?
Get your pants on and come into the office.
Oh, what's the matter?
Never mind. Come on.
Okay. Listen, Rabbit. What are we going to do about a left-handed pitcher?
Later, later. Joe, I had an idea. I thought we could take one of the right-handers and sew the letter backwards across his shirt, and maybe that'd fool the other club.
Yeah.
Come on inside.
Or maybe we ought to disguise Iron Mike, the batting practice robot.
All right, that's enough. Joe, the old man's dead.
What?
I said he's dead, old man Castle. Heart attack. I figured we had him scared so he'd loosen up a little dough for players, and then he goes and does this to us. Can't trust nobody.
Well, who gets the club?
His son.
What, you mean Whistling Willie Castle, the Jetstream playboy?
That's who.
But he doesn't know anything about a ball club.
He doesn't have to. Old man Castle owns 72% of the stock. And it all goes to Willie.
Well, what's going to happen?
Beats me. Probably sell us all out and buy a new rocket.
Is he here?
He was in the Earth-Moon small boat race when it happened. They got a message to him when he hit the direct beam off Lunaport. He could have landed and taken the shuttle back and made it in one day. But he was leading in the race, so he just kept going. He's due in a couple hours.
You think you can get him to go for a left-handed pitcher?
I don't know. We'll have to try.
Of course, you've heard of Willie Castle. About once a year, he cracks up some expensive sports rocket or gets himself picked up in a survival suit by the IP, floating somewhere in an orbit around the moon. He almost got put away a couple of years ago when he took a debutante up in a Harrison Kilgore cruiser and kept her in orbit for 2 months. The old man was able to kill the abduction charges by claiming that they'd been married at the time. And one time when the old man had a couple of us up at the lodge he lives in during spring training, I saw the kid's room. It was filled with Marak heads that he'd shot on safaris on Mars. He came down to the training camp a week later. He buzzed over in a Harley Donaldson atmospheric and set the ship down in the hole between second and third, burning out half the infield. I saw a Rabbit get him to one side and start talking fast, so I sneaked over and listened.
Well, Mr. Castle, of course you know we're all very sorry about your father's death.
He had it coming, the old tightwad.
Oh, well, I see.
I couldn't convince him that a credit isn't any good to you, stuffed in the mattress. You got to spend, isn't that right?
Yeah, it is. As a matter of fact, that's what I wanted to see you about. Now, there's a boy in one of the Milwaukee farm clubs, a left-handed pitcher. I can get him for about $30,000 and a couple of players. And
what do you mean?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right, Mr. Castle. You got to spend money. And if we could get a little help in pitching and maybe an outfielder or two...
You mean spend money for baseball players?
Well, yeah. That was what I had in mind.
Now, wait a minute. This baseball team was my father's hobby, like some old men collect stamps or play checkers. Now, in the terms of the will, I can't sell it. But I'm sure not going to throw any good money away on something foolish like baseball players.
Oh, I see.
As a matter of fact, I'm going to need all the cash I can lay my hands on.
Yeah?
Yeah. I've got a chance to buy a 3-pile nuclear eraser that'll cut 2 weeks off the round trip to Mars.
Oh, I see. You wouldn't want to spend money on anything as foolish as ball play.
That's it. You've got the idea now. Oh, by the way, Mr. Cinadella.
Yeah?
I find it's quite embarrassing to me to have my friends continually make fun of me because the Dodgers are in last place.
Well, as a matter of fact, that gets to be a touchy point with me, too.
Well, I'd like to see a change, so if you don't mind, would you please have them somewhere in a more respectable position, say third or second, within a month or two?
Now, look here, Mr. Castle, I can't make bricks without straw. You won't spend the credit for a ball player, and I can't...
You do your best.
Well, after that interview with the new owner, Rabbit went out and tied one on. And I had to run the ball club for 2 days till we got him straightened out. But I can't say as I blamed him. We won one game in the Grapefruit League. We played the Jacksonville High School team and squeaked out a 13-12 victory. What the Yankees and Braves did to us, I'd rather not say. We opened the season at home, and a mediocre pitcher for Pittsburgh threw a no-hitter at us. Actually, that's not quite accurate. The truth is, he just pitched, and we didn't hit anything. We lost 10 straight from opening day, and we didn't lose on the 11th day because it rained. Rabbit and me piled into his 97 copter and flew out to the Castle Estate up near Arrowhead. I was in pretty bad shape. For one thing, Rabbit's copter had a wobble, and I was feeling green around the gills by the time we dropped down on the port. Willie Castle was very excited by the time we finally got to see him. He was puttering around a whole mess of stuff piled up in the middle of the floor.
Say, how do you like this? Isn't it exciting?
Yeah. What is it?
It's a Durgo stick.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And they use it in Mars in a game played between two villages. You see all the men on one side line up, and then all the men on the other side try to knock them over with these sticks. Isn't it a beauty?
Yeah. Look, Mr. Castle, I got to speak to you. We got to have a left-handed pitcher.
Oh, you mean for the baseball team?
Yeah, that's right, the baseball team. That's what we got to have a left-handed pitcher for, yeah.
Well, now, I can't really be bothered with details of that sort. I'm leaving for Mars in the morning. Oh, by the way, I haven't had a chance to look at the standings recently. How are we doing?
Mr. Castle, we may well set them out on record for consecutive games lost. Now, look here. You told me you can't sell the club. And you said you get tired of your friends kidding about being last. Well, take it from me, Mr. Castle, and I know. Unless we get some ball players on that club, it's going to be last for the next 22 years.
Now, look here, Cinderella.
I know you can fire me, but I don't care who you hire as manager. Unless you get him a left-handed pitcher and a couple of other players, that club is going to stay last.
Oh. Oh, well, then I'll see what I can do. Don't worry about it.
What do you mean, don't worry about it? I got to go out there every day and try to make those bums go through the motions.
Now, look, I really have to pack. And besides, I'm expecting a new shipment of equipment from Aberfitch and Combi. Now, just don't worry about it. I'll think of something. Goodbye.
Next day, we lost a doubleheader to Cincinnati by a score faintly reminiscent of basketball. And that's the way it went. Oh, we won a couple here and there. Like they say, you know, you can't lose them all. About the middle of the season, we were so far behind that the local papers just dropped us off the standings, didn't even bother to report it. It was about this time that Willie Castle returned from Mars. He came out to see us at the ballpark just before the massacre.
Well, I noticed, Mr. Cinderella, that we're still in last place.
Yeah, Mr. Castle, we are. We are lucky we are still in the league. The ball players that you've given me.
Well, I just wanted to tell you that I made a small bet with one of the boys at the country club.
Yeah?
Yes. I bet a million credits that we'd win the pennant this year.
That's nice.
You don't seem to understand. I expect to win that bet.
Yeah, sure. And I expect to put on a Monroe suit and win the Miss Universe title.
I told you to leave everything to me. Now, I'd like you to come into my office, if you please. I have a few things I'd like to talk over with you. For one thing, I've signed a ball player.
You what? Now, look here, Mr. Castle. This I got to complain about. My contract is clear. No ball player gets signed without my okay.
Just come into my office, please. I'll explain everything.
That night, when Rabbit went up to the plate to hand in the starting lineups, I could tell something was happening. For one thing, old Baldy Snuff, the umpire, was looking at the card like it was written in Arabic.
All right, who's the pitcher?
It's written right there in the card.
Saramo Castro Perbaco.
What's the matter, can't you read?
Oh, come on now, you kidding? Is he Armenian?
Nope. Martian.
Martian?
That's right. Martian.
Of course, the riot didn't really start until our pitcher got out on the mound. Fred Kurtz, the Milwaukee manager, came running out like he'd been shot from a jet. Baldy Snuff was hollering. The whole Milwaukee bench was looking for a fight, but Rabbit just stood there quiet and calm.
He can't do that. He can't do that. Look at that thing. What is that?
That's my pitcher. We call him Sam.
But you can't play with that. That ain't a ball player. That isn't even a human being.
What are you trying to pull, Rabbit?
Listen, I got my rights. I sign them legal. Here's the contract.
But, Rabbit, you can't get away with that. That thing's only about 2 feet high.
18 inches, as a matter of fact.
But how's he gonna pitch? He hasn't even got any arms.
Sure he has. He's got it curled up. Hey, Sam, wind up.
But that arm, it's
32 feet long.
That ain't legal. You gonna let him get away with that?
Oh, there's one other thing. On the end of that arm, look, you see? That's his eye.
Rabbit, I'm going to punch you right in the nose.
Now, take it easy, Kurtz. Take it easy.
Look, I got the papers all here. I've got the United Nations Concordat with the Marshall Colonial Government, a Supreme Court decision in the case of Schultz versus Karawa, Kalpabor, Kalfitz, et al. It's legal. Any Martian citizen is entitled to the same legal rights and privileges as a citizen of Earth. And among those is the right to play ball in a national league.
I protest again. I forfeit the game. Rabbit, I'm going to punch you right in the nose.
As a matter of fact, the game that night was postponed because of riot. The next morning, everybody met in the commissioner's office, and sure enough, it was legal. Martian Sam, we come to call him, was a legally signed player for the Los Angeles Dodgers.
I told you not to worry. I found Sam in a village just north of Marsport. He's a Klugel hunter.
A what?
A Klugel hunter. Klugels are fast little animals that run about 80 miles an hour, and the hunters go out and throw rocks at them and kill them. Sam's a Klugel hunter. He ought to be a pretty good pitcher.
How about the other clubs? What happens if they get Klugel hunters?
Oh, they won't. You see, it's basically contrary to Martian psychology. They won't ever leave their own villages.
Then how come Sam left?
Well, it was an unfortunate accident, really. You see, when I first met him, I gave him a stick of chewing gum.
Yeah?
Well, he got hooked.
What do you mean, hooked?
Well, for Martians, the chicle seems to be habit-forming. Sam is a gum addict. Well, naturally, as soon as this was discovered, the traffic was prohibited. There's a death penalty for importing of chewing gum to Mars. But it was too late for Sam, so he came out with me.
You mean all we gotta do is keep him supplied with chewing gum?
That's right. I told you I'd take care of it, didn't I? Now you've got your left-handed pitcher.
Sam pitched that night. He struck out 27 batters, and we won 3-0. Horse Kelly, the catcher, had a little trouble at first, but he soon figured out how to get around it. He'd just hold his mitt up and close his eyes, and when he heard a thunk, he'd reach in and pull the ball out and throw it back to Sam. You can imagine what it was like being a batter up there against Sam. Pitcher's mound is only 60 feet away from the plate as it is. And with Sam's 32-foot arm, well, we didn't lose the game the rest of the season. Of course, we started out so far behind that by the last game of the season, we were tied with the Milwaukees, and we were playing them at Milwaukee. The winner of this game won the pennant. Of course, it was a lead pipe cinch for us. Martian Sam had pitched every day since he joined the club. He looked real cute out on the mound, standing 18 inches high in his little Dodgers uniform and in that long 32-foot arm. We had taken a finished batting practice at Milwaukee County Stadium, and I was standing next to Willie Castle's box talking to him.
Well, it looks like I won't have to be embarrassed about owning the Los Angeles Dodgers anymore, eh?
That's right. With Sam pitching, that means we win the pennant and the series.
Well, I think that's very nice. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking of taking the whole team on a barnstorming tour through Mars after the series is
over. Hey, Joe! Joe! Oh,
Mr. Castle.
Well, what's the matter?
It's Sam. Sam.
Well, what's the matter? Is anything wrong with him? Did he get his chewing gum?
Yeah, he got his chewing gum, but he's just lying on the floor in the locker room moaning.
He is. We better get a doctor.
Yeah, and all those scales keep falling off him.
Oh, no, no.
What's the matter?
I know what it is.
What?
It's the molting season. All the scales will fall off. It'll take him a week to grow new scales.
But he can pitch, can't he?
No, he can't. Any violent movement would bring on great pain.
Well, there goes the ball game. Marsh and Sam can't pitch. We're dead.
Rabbit put it mild. We were good and dead. We pitched Harry Kuznowski, our best human pitcher, but our best human pitcher was none too good. He rose to the occasion, however, and the score was tied going into the last half of the ninth.
That's the way, Harry, old boy! That's the way, Purdy! Come on, Harry! You can do it, baby!
Unfortunately, he couldn't. He hit a streak of wildness and walked three straight men. Things were very quiet in the Dodgers' dugout. One more walk would force in a run, the ball game would be over. Then as we all sat there staring out at the mound where Harry was sweating, we heard a little shuffling noise.
Hey, what's that? Sam, what are you doing out here?
And then with the little squeaks that he used for talking, Sam told us what he wanted to do. He wanted a pitch.
But Sam, you can't. You're molting. Your scales. All right, Sam, all right. If that's the way you want it, you get out there. You picture that one batter. It's two out. You strike him out, it'll go to extra innings, and we'll win the ball game.
And so Marsh and Sam trudged out to the pitcher's mound, his tiny legs lagging with great pain. You could just tell the little guy was hurting bad.
Now pitching for Los Angeles, Marsh and Sam.
We knew that Sam could do it now. We only had to face one batter and we'd get our chance again. Horse threw the ball out to him and Sam stood there, his eye on the end of his 32-foot arm, blinking with pain.
All right, batter up. Let's get a batter in there.
The umpire called for the batter and nobody came out of the Milwaukee dugout.
Hey, come on, let's go. Hey, Kurtz, get a man up in there.
What's the matter, Baldy?
Let's get a batter in there. You're delaying the game.
What do you mean I'm delaying the game?
You get a batter up there.
But I got a batter up there.
What do you mean? There's nobody in the batter's box.
Baldy, I got a contract here for you to read.
What are you talking about?
Yeah. Read it.
Well, of course, everybody knows what happened. The Milwaukee Braves had signed an intelligent virus from the moons of Jupiter. He was up there in the batter's box, but of course you couldn't see him without an electron microscope. He walked on four straight pitches, forcing in a run, and the Milwaukee's won the pennant. But like I say, that's baseball. You can't win them all.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, which this month features Time in the Round by Fritz Leiber, the story of a dictator who suffered more than any dictator in history. He was so puny, and his victims were so impregnable. Galaxy Magazine, on your newsstand today. Tonight, X-1 has brought you Martian Sam, an original story written for radio by Ernest Canoy. Featured in the cast were Mandel Kramer as Joe, Santos Ortega as Rabbit, Ivor Francis as Willie, Jack Orison as Baldy, Bob Hastings as Tommy, and Bill Zuckert as Kurtz. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Daniel Sutter and is an NBC Radio Network production.
Next is a short story from the LibriVox project. It was originally published in Fantastic Universe for November of 1954.
Lost in the Future. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Lost in the Future by John Victor Peterson. They had discovered a new planet, but its people did not see them until after they had traveled on. Albrecht and I went down in a shuttle ship, leaving the Stellatomic orbited pole to pole 2,000 miles above Alpha Centauri's second planet. While we took an atmosphere-brushing approach, which wouldn't burn off the shuttle's skin, we went as swiftly as we could. A week before, we had completed man's first trip through hyperspace. We were now making the first landing on an inhabited planet of another sun. All the preliminary investigations had been made via electron spectroscopes and electron telescopes from the Stellatomic. We knew that the atmosphere was breathable and were reasonably certain that the peoples of the world into whose atmosphere we were dropping were at peace. We went unarmed, just the two of us. It might not be wise to go in force. We were silent, and I know that Harry Albrecht was as perplexed as I was over the fact that our all-wave receivers failed to pick up any signs of radio communication whatever. We had assumed that we would pick up signals of some type as soon as we had passed down through the unfamiliar planet's ionosphere. The scattered arrangement of the towering cities appeared to call for radio communications. The hundreds of atmosphere ships flashing along a system of airways between the cities seemed to indicate the existence of electronic navigational and landing aids, but perhaps the signals were all tightly beamed. We would know when we came lower. We dropped into the airway levels, and still our receivers failed to pick up a signal of any sort, not even a whisper of static, and, strangely, our radar scopes failed to record even a blip from their atmosphere ships. "I guess it's our equipment, Harry," I said. "It just doesn't seem to function in this atmosphere. We'll have to put Edwards to work on it when we get back upstairs." We spotted an airport on the outskirts of a large city. The runways were laid out with the precision of Earth's finest. I put our ship's nose eastward on a runway and took it down fast through a lull in the atmosphere ship traffic. As we went down, I saw a tiny building spotted on the field, which surely housed electronic equipment, but our receivers remained silent. I taxied the shuttle up to an unloading ramp before the airport's terminal building, and I killed the drive. "Harry," I said, "if it weren't that their ships are so outlandishly stubby and their buildings so outflung, we might well be on Earth." "I agree, Captain. Strange, though, that they're not mobbing us. They couldn't take this Delta Wing job for one of their ships." It was strange. I looked up at the observation ramp's occupants, people who, except for their bizarre dress, might well be of Earth, and saw no curiosity in the eyes that sometimes swept across our position. "Be that as it may, Harry, we certainly should cause a stir in these pressure suits. Let's go." We walked up to a dour-looking individual at a counter at the ramp's end. Clearing my throat, I said rather inanely, "Hello, but what does one say to an extrasolarian?" I realized then that my voice seemed thunderous, that the only other sounds came from a distance, the city's noise, the atmosphere ship's engines on the horizon. The Centaurian ignored us. I looked at the atmosphere ships in the clear blue sky, at the Centaurians on the ramp who appeared to be conversing, and there was no sound from those planes, no sound from the people. "It's impossible," Harry said. "The atmosphere's nearly Earth normal. It should be, well, damn it, it is, as sound conductive. We're talking, aren't we?" I looked up at the Centaurians again. They were looking excitedly westward. Some turned to companions. Mouths opened and closed to form words we could not hear. Wide eyes lowered, following something I could not see. Sick inside, I turned to Albrecht and read confirmation in his drawn, blanched face. "Captain," he said, "I suspected that we might find something like this when we first came out of hyperspace and the big sleep. The recorders showed we'd exceeded light speed in normal space-time just after the transition. Einstein theorized that time would not pass as swiftly to those approaching light speed. We could safely exceed that speed in hyperspace, but should never have done so in normal space-time. Beyond light-speed time must conversely accelerate. These people haven't seen us yet. They certainly just observed our landing, as we suspected. They probably do have speech and radio, but we can't pick up either. We're seconds ahead of them in time, and we can't pick up from the past sounds of nearby origin. or nearby signals radiated at light speed. They'll see and hear us soon, but we'll never receive an answer from them. Our questions will come to them in their future, but we can never pick answers from their past. Let's go, Harry, I said quickly. Where? He asked. Where can we ever go that will be an improvement over this? He was resigned. Back into space, I said. Back to circle this system at near light speed. The computer should be able to determine how long and how slow we'll have to fly to cancel this out. If not, we are truly and forever lost. End of Lost in the Future by John Victor Peterson.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock, 5, 7, 6, 9, 8 o'clock rock, 9, 13, 14, 17, or, just a minute, or to hell with it.
A lot can be said about Peter Lorre, among which is that he was born to do radio. He just comes onto the scene and begins to chew up the scenery beautifully. And he does it every time. He does it here in his NBC summer replacement show for Abbott and Costello, Mystery in the Air, which was sponsored by Camel Cigarettes and ran between 1945 and 1947. Unfortunately, only 8 episodes survive. Those are all from 1947. We can always hope that more will show up. Sometimes that happens. Oh, and there's another familiar voice on here. That's Harry Morgan. You know, Colonel Powder from MASH. He was around a long time. He's gone now, of course. Not very long. Just since December the 7th of 2011. And he had a long life. He was 96 when he died. Still, maybe we should take a moment to miss him. For today's show, Lorre and Associates have a go at The Lodger, which was originally a silent film directed by Alfred Hitchcock in 1926, and has been the basis of 4 subsequent movies and countless TV and radio shows. One more thing. As I said, there were only 8 surviving episodes of Mystery in the Air, and kind of regrettably, this is the 8th one. This will be the final airing of Mystery in the Air and Night Transmissions. I wish there were more. But fortunately, like I said, Lorre did a lot of radio, so he'll be back at least.
Mystery in the Air, starring Peter Lorre. Presented by Camel Cigarettes.
All right, men. I guess that's all. Put him on the stretcher and take him to the morgue.
Oh, must I stay, Inspector?
For a while, Mrs. Bunting.
Oh, dear.
I need all the details for my report.
Oh, that such a thing could have happened here. Here in my own house.
Each week at this hour, Peter Lorre brings us the excitement of the great stories of the strange and unusual, of dark and compelling masterpieces culled from the four corners of world literature. Tonight, The Lodger, by Mrs. Bella Clown. Peter Lorre is the lodger, and Ellen Bunting is played by Miss Agnes Moorhead. Mystery in the Air, brought to you by Camel Cigarettes.
down, Mrs. Bunting. You said you were looking for a lodger?
Yes, Inspector, we had to. But I never dreamed such a thing could happen here, to us. Why, it was only last Tuesday night my husband and I were sitting before our fire reading the newspaper about the latest murder. It was the theft by the Avenger. Yes, I remember saying distinctly, Robert, this Avenger person, you know, he could be the fellow standing next to you, or maybe the man you bump into. It's a terrible thought.
Yes, but it appears to me that the Avenger's too quick for the police.
And look here, it says this girl he got last night was like all the others, pretty blonde, and she'd just come from the music hall, exactly like all the rest of his victims. Oh, what a pity.
Ellen, have you stopped to think who fits that description perfectly? Our own Daisy.
Oh, sure. What a pretty thought, Bunting. It's a good thing she's with her aunt instead of here. London isn't a safe place for any girl now.
Just the same, I can't help thinking how fine it would be to have her here with us.
Well, there's no sense even talking about it. We just can't afford it.
I know that, Ellen, but I hope we could manage it some way.
How? Haven't I scrimped myself half crazy trying to keep us going?
I know, Ellen. Well, don't you go worrying about it. I think we can...
Who do you suppose that could be?
Could it be someone looking for a room?
Oh, I wish it were. Then you could have your Daisy back. Well, I went to the front door, and when I opened it, there stood a man wearing a black cape and hat. He carried but a single piece of luggage. Good evening, sir.
I saw your sign. It says you have a room to rent.
Yes, sir. Please, won't you come in?
Thank you.
Could I take your case, sir?
No, I'm looking for a quiet room, but it should be very quiet.
Oh, we have that, sir. Just that. Above all, our house is quiet. Okay. Your bag, sir. May I take it?
No, just show me the room, please.
Oh, yes, sir. It's right up these stairs, sir. This way. You see, sir, there's just my husband and me here, and we're ever so quiet. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you'll find this room to your liking. Well, here we are.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think I like this room.
Yes, it is pleasant, isn't it? There's not many rooms with such pretty pictures, now is there?
I don't know. Pretty pictures interest me very little. What I like about this room is the simplicity. I like the bareness. Yes, I think I'll take it. What is your name?
Mrs. Bunt, sir.
All right, Mrs. Bunting, I'll take the room.
Oh, yes, sir. And please let me help you with your luggage.
No, don't you touch it.
Oh, but I only wish to...
I know. You only wish to help, Miss Bunting. It's just, forgive me. It's just that I'm weary. I'm very tired. See, I do a lot of studying.
Oh, yes, of course, sir, of course.
Well, anyway, you can see how few things I need. It's just what's in this bag. But this... This here is my favorite book.
Hmm?
The Bible. Good book, Mrs. Bunting, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, indeed it is, sir.
Yes, it says, he brings them to their desired haven.
Hmm?
Beautiful words, huh? And now at last I have found my haven of rest. Now, Mrs. Bunting, if I pay you 30 shillings a week for this room, that's satisfactory?
Sir, yes, sir, that'll be quite all right.
My name is Sleuth.
Mr. Sleuth?
Yes, Sleuth. S-L-E-U-T-H. Think of a hound, Mrs. Bunting, and you'll never forget my name. Here are your 30 shillings.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you. Would you be wishing anything now? Supper, tea, or...
No, nothing. Good night, Miss Bunting.
Yes, good night, sir.
Please stop that. You hear?
What did I do?
You were humming. That's music.
Oh, but I...
Music is an instrument of sin.
Oh, yes, sir.
And you did tell me, Mrs. Bunting, that your house would be absolutely quiet.
Oh, but it is, sir. I didn't mean any harm. Believe me, sir.
I believe you. I'm sorry I spoke sharply. I know you. You're trying to be considerate and kind.
Oh, thank you, sir. By
the way, Mrs. Bunting, I think I would like some bread and some tea.
Oh, certainly, sir. I'll have it in an instant.
Sir,
So he took the room, eh, Ellen?
Yes.
He took the room at 30 shillings a week.
Yes, in advance. Oh, hurry now, Bunting. Is the water for the tea hot yet?
Yes, what a stroke.
Put the bread and the butter on the tray. I'll pour the water.
You know, Ellen, it's wonderful.
Yes, it is.
Do you realize what this means? We can have Daisy back with
us
now.
Yes, I know. Hurry with it now, hurry.
Why, we can have her back with us tomorrow.
Now, there's the water and the tea, and I guess, yes, it's all ready. Open the door, Bunting. I'll take it up to him right away.
There you go, old girl. First thing in the morning, I'm going to fetch Daisy and bring her home. Oh, it's a wonderful night, Ellen. Wonderful.
Oh, I mustn't do it.
Yes, darling. You from her. Yes, from Nana. Been by her. Come in.
And to know how the wickedness of folly...
Why, Mr. Sleuth, you...
Yes? What is it?
Those pictures. Hmm? Those pretty girls. You've turned all their faces
yes,
to the wall.
Yes, I've turned them to the wall because they are wicked and sinful.
Oh, but, sir, I...
Don't you agree, Mrs. Bunting, that everything wicked and sinful should be purged from the earth? Huh?
Yes, I do.
I'm happy to hear that, Mrs. Bunting. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to leave.
Oh, but, sir, here's your tray.
Good night, Mrs. Bunting.
You know, for a moment, I was deep with fear. I set the tray down. He hadn't so much as noticed the light supper I'd put for him and rushed to the window to watch. He came out of our cottage and moved off down the street, his black cape swirling about him. Finally, he was lost in the fog, and I don't know why, but I stared after him for a long, long while. Well, I did the dishes and got ready for bed. I lay there thinking, and it was almost dawn before I had convinced myself that at most he was a trifle odd. And after all, paying 30 shillings, maybe he had a right to his strange ways. It was daylight when I was suddenly awakened by the newsboys shouting in the street.
All of a murder, read all about
murder at King's Cross last night. Avenger strikes again.
Slowly, I realized what the newsboys were shouting.
Horrible murder, Avenger, 26 victims.
Oh, no.
Avenger at work again. Another girl falls victim to a knife. Avenger strikes again.
The inspector takes notes of the terrifying event. Ellen Bunting continues the story.
And now, Mrs. Bunting, what did you do the morning you learned the Avenger had murdered his sixth victim?
Well, I was a little frightened to meet our lodger, yet I kept my thought to myself. After all, you know, there still wasn't much to go on. Robert had gone to meet Daisy, so Mr. Sleuth ate breakfast alone. I watched him through the crack in the door. Finally, I went in with more tea.
Tea? No. No, thank you. Thank you, Mrs. Bunting. I don't care for any more tea, thanks. You're very kind, but I have to go on with my work now, if you'll excuse me.
My fear really changed to pity then. Oh, he seemed so helpless and tired. And he was so considerate. This man couldn't be a murderer. It was all a coincidence. Besides, we just couldn't afford to lose that 30 shillings a week. Well, around 10 in the morning, he left the cottage, and I decided to go upstairs and have a look about his room. I had to find out what he carried in his one piece of luggage. It wasn't a bag. It was more like a case. Yes, a case.
A case for a knife.
I rushed upstairs, my heart beating wildly at the thought I'd had of the case. No, there wasn't anything in his closet. I went over to the chest of drawers against the wall. Nothing in the top one. In the next one, there was just some socks and some underclothes. The next one was empty. There was only one other place for the small, narrow case, the bottom drawer. And it was locked. I pulled and pulled at it. And then suddenly I heard the front door open downstairs. In a panic, I rushed out of the room and down the hall.
Oh, you're upstairs, Ellen. Oh. Ellen, Daisy's here.
Oh, thank heaven.
Oh, Mother, it's so good to see you. It's so good to be home.
Why, whatever's the matter?
Yes, you're quite white, Ellen.
Oh, I'm all right. It's just that I wasn't expecting you so soon.
Well, it's good to be back. The country's all right, but there's nothing like London now, is there?
Oh, no. No, there isn't.
Well, as long as that Avenger's about, you're going to have something to do to keep this young lady indoors, London or no London.
Oh, don't you worry. Mother will see to that.
Oh, well, Daisy, I might as well get you settled.
You see, Father, what did I tell you? She'll have a dust cloth in my hand before I have my coat on.
Mr. Sleuth.
Why is my door open?
We were just leaving, sir.
Have you been in my room?
Oh, not at all. Sir.
From now on, Mrs. Bunting, I shall keep my room locked.
But you see, sir, I was just tidying up a bit, and Mr. Bunting, he brought our daughter home. She just arrived. This is Daisy.
Pleased to meet you, sir.
She's been away for quite a while. That's why we're a bit excited, you might say.
Yes.
You were probably surprised to hear us laughing and carrying on.
Yes, I must say I was, But then, there are different kinds of joy, are there not, Daisy?
Yes, I'm sure there are.
Yes, there is the despicable, evil joy of the abandoned, and then there is the divine happiness of the blessed. That's a great difference. You understand that, Daisy, don't you?
Why, yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Sleuth.
Good, dear. There are so few young women nowadays who do.
Why, Mr. Sleuth, you mean a girl's not to enjoy life at all? Not to have any fun?
Enjoyment and fun, my child, are a devil's breeding ground. All his implements are there. Pleasure and impropriety. The temptation of music, dancing.
Oh, that's crazy. Why, there's nothing I like better than dancing. And I'm not...
You like to dance?
She didn't know what she was saying, Mr. Sleuth. She's just a child. Daisy, you know you've never been one for dancing. You never learned how
to... But I did learn, Mother. While I was away. What's so wrong about it? What's the harm in dancing?
It says she lies in wait for a prey and increases the transgressors among men.
I don't know what you mean. I've never heard such nonsense.
Nonsense? You call it scripture nonsense?
Daisy, go into the front room.
It's all right, Miss Bunting. All right. I'm used to that talk. Good day.
Daisy?
Yes,
Daisy.
What, Mom?
I've got to tell you about...
About what?
Oh, nothing. I've got to go out for a while now. I'll be back.
For a moment, I was about to tell her my awful suspicions, but I stopped. They were only suspicions. At the same time, I had a thought. I'd go to the coroner's inquest they were having for the Avengers' latest victim. I was hoping to hear something said that cleared my suspicions of the lodger. At least I'd give him this last chance. A lady was testifying as I took my seat. She'd seen the Avenger from her window, she said, and her description of him didn't tally with Mr. Sleuth at all. Oh, I can't tell you how relieved I was. Till it was pointed out she couldn't possibly have seen anyone that night from her window because of the fog. Then the next witness was a Mr. Cannot. I leaned forward anxiously as they swore him in and began asking questions.
You say, Mr. Kennedy, you're positive that you saw this man?
Positive, sir. It was only a few moments before the murder that I saw the Avenger.
Describe him.
Well, he wore a black cape and was very gaunt-looking and was carrying a small handbag.
A handbag?
Yes, a small, narrow handbag, such a one as might contain a knife.
Silence in the court. Proceed, Mr. Kennedy.
Well, he had a low, hesitating voice. I'd say with something of a continent lax. An educated man, I judge, but quite mad.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, as he emerged from the fog, talking aloud to himself. Believe me, sir, he was citing scriptures from the Bible.
Oh, no, it can't be. It can't be. Could there be any doubt about it now? Mr. Sleuth, our lodger, he was the murderer. I got out of the courtroom as quickly as I could. I didn't even notice it had started to rain. I hardly remember going home. running and walking somehow, while the nightmare of fear and terror grew bigger and bigger inside me. It was 3 streets from our cottage that I saw my husband, Robert. One thought hit me clearly. I realized Daisy must be home alone with the Avenger. Bunting! Bunting!
Why, Ellen, what is it?
Bunting, where's Daisy? Where is she? Where's Daisy?
Why, she's at home.
Oh, listen, listen, Bunting, listen. Sleuth! Sleuth is the Avenger.
What? What are you saying?
Ah, Larger, he's the Avenger. Daisy's alone with him right now. Hurry! Hurry!
Listen to me carefully, my child, and rejoice with me in your heart, for the moment is at hand, and you're not afraid, Daisy, are you?
No, I'm not afraid.
You're very beautiful, and you should live in the ways of righteousness. You hear me, Daisy? You want to live in the ways of righteousness, don't you?
Yes, yes, I do.
I know you do. I know, and that is why I've been sent to purge your soul, so that you will be elevated beyond all sin and evil. You like to dance, Daisy, don't you? Already 6 have gone on before you, and they are beyond all sin and evil. You are the 7th to be elevated, my child, and my work is almost done for the 7th. I've promised this appointed hour. Be still, Daisy. And don't listen to the temptations of the crowd when they call out your name. Because I am here to save you from all evil and wickedness that consumes you like a wildfire of scarlet and crimson. You like to dance, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Look at me, my child. Look at me and don't fear me. And do not tremble. Woe to them that call evil good and good evil, and put darkness for light and light for darkness, and therefore I must bring you down like the lamb to slaughter. And now I lift my hand with a flaming sword, for now comes the vengeance and the time to rejoice.
Daddy, you kill a baby, come here.
Let that knife, you please!
Oh,
you're safe! Take off that knife, you!
Take away your hand! Let go of me! Get away! Don't you know that such that are for death to death, and such that are for the sword to the sword, and no one dare to have pity on them?
His knife!
Oh, he fell on the knife.
Yeah, and it's burning. It's burning like a fire. Oh, it purges me and consumes me. All sin and evil are falling away. Praise and glory, for it is I who is the 7th. Yes, the vengeance is fulfilled.
Week, Mystery in the Air, starring Mr. Peter Lorre, brings you one of the world's great stories of the strange and unusual, The Horror by de Maupassant, with a special musical score composed and conducted by Paul Barron. Listen again next week at this same time when the makers of Camel Cigarettes present Mr. Peter Lorre in Mystery in the Air.
The artists supporting Mr. Lorry tonight were Agnes Moorhead as Ellen, Henry Morgan as the voice of mystery, Barbara Eiler as Daisy, Eric Snowden as Bunting, Raymond Lawrence as the inspector, Rolf Sedan as the witness, and Conrad Binion as the newsboy. And on behalf of Mr. Lorry and the entire cast, our sincere thanks to Agnes Moorhead for her great portrayal of Ellen Bunting. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
Okay, that's it. This is another Night Transmissions in the can. Oh, by the way, you should go to the website, nighttransmissions.com. Night Transmissions, just one word. And on that page, you'll find information about everything that was on the show. Well, nearly everything. Usually everything. Oh, and I don't mention this often enough. There's a phone number. A G-voice phone number. The odds of you getting through to me or any human being are rather remote. But it is a good place to leave messages. And I like it when that happens. The Google Voice number is 541-995-0594. Give us a call. In any case, just a thought. And on the way out, I'm going to play The Beautiful Isle of Somewhere, as recorded by John McCormick by Edison Recording Company in 1901. If you want, you can think of it as a sentimental tribute to Harry Morgan and all of the talent, all of the people who make up old-time radio who we have lost over the years. See ya. That was the 1901 Edison recording of the beautiful Isle of Somewhere, as sung by John McCormick. I'm Gary Clinton, and maybe I'll see you somewhere.
Somewhere the song of dwells.